Owner Jorge Calderon also owned a paint and body shop near the airport, the chop shop that Marco Arroyo had used for the black pickup after the heist. According to the FBI's source, Leonard Timms, Calderon spent every Friday night at the club. It was their best lead of the week. There was no further information on Marco Arroyo. Octavio Alvarez had returned to work at Braxton Security on Tuesday. No more suspicious activity. The plan at night moves was for the hot new couple to prowl their way over to Mr. Calderon and see if anything came up, so to speak. They pulled into the parking lot just before midnight, and Sosa found the last open space. Night Moves claimed to be South Florida's largest adult lifestyle nightclub, the premier playground for sexy couples and select singles. Theme nights were popular. Andy was relieved to see that they'd missed Thursday's Sushi in the Raw night. Eating raw fish off the hairy chest of some man she'd never met wasn't her cup of Japanese tea. "No cover charge tonight if you wear pink pasties," said Sosa, pointing to the sign outside the entrance. "Not gonna happen," said Andy. The club was BYOB, no liquor license, so Andy brought a faux bottle of vodka to share. Dance music greeted them as they stepped into the entrance lobby. The sign on the wall said, "Do not enter if you are offended by any form of nudity or sexual activity," but the disrobing came later. Smart and sexy attire was required of anyone who didn't dress in line with the night's theme of pink pasties, schoolgirl, or whatever. The bouncer gave Andy the thumbs up on her backless black cocktail dress. The attendant at the front desk checked their photo IDs, which were convincing fakes. Then she ran their names through the club's database. Andy was Celia Sellers.
"First-timers, I see," said the attendant. "I'll ask a couple of our club mentors to show you around."
"That's not necessary," said Andy. "It's mandatory. I'll be right back."
Mentors and a tour weren't mentioned in the FBI field dossier that Andy had studied. The bouncer explained after the attendant stepped away.
"It's not really mandatory. It's for newbies they want to impress."
"Flattered, I'm sure."
The attendant returned with the mentors and made the quick introductions. The tour protocol was to separate the men from the women. Agent Sosa went off with a good-looking Latino who could have been his fraternity brother. The men disappeared into the noisy dance studio. Priscilla took Andy down the hall to a quiet lounge where they could talk.
"You two married?" asked Priscilla.
"No, just dating."
"When's the last time you had sex with someone else?"
"Too long." She wasn't lying.
"Good attitude," said Priscilla.
A handful of couples were at the bar, all fully clothed and in keeping with the smart and sexy dress code. Andy wasn't in South Beach, but so far the look and feel of the club was no different. Night Moves was not your grandmother's swing club. No Charlie's Angels wannabes inviting men with long sideburns to have sex on skanky shag carpeting. Priscilla led her to a seat on the couch, crossed her legs, and smiled. The tattoo script in her calf jumped out at Andy. "Not all who wander are lost."
"Let me tell you what's happening right now," said Priscilla. "Your boyfriend is getting the full tour. First, he'll see the dance floor, which can be pretty erotic. Some people will be dressed, others will be undressing. Some will be touching. A few might be doing more. Then the tour will head over to the Red Room. This is where you can actually do the things you were fantasizing about on the dance floor. If you feel like it, you can bring along some new friends you've only just met. The Red Room can suit any member's comfort level. Some people like to do it in the open, where anyone can watch.
the Lovenasium, we call it. Others like a private cabana. Some of our members will walk around completely naked. Others want a robe. It's up to you.
Andy considered her response, mindful that she needed to work within the restrictions on acceptable agent conduct in the FBI Undercover Operations Manual.
I'll be honest, I'm not going to make it to the Red Room on my first visit.
Don't worry. It's not even part of tonight's tour for you, said Priscilla.
But your boyfriend will come back from there all pumped up for an orgy and ready to sign on the dotted line for a lifetime club membership. My advice to you on the first visit is to have fun and keep your clothes on. Then go home and have the best sex you and your boyfriend have ever had.
That sounds like good advice, said Andy.
It is.
You're the kind of people we want. You have class. You're beautiful.
And as much as the club's marketing materials say that the membership is mostly people in their 20s and 30s, an awful lot of folks only wish they were that young again.
The club needs more people like us.
Andy tried not to smile too cynically. Priscilla was clearly in the wishful category.
So, Priscilla said, rising, let me show you the dance floor.
Priscilla led the way, and Andy followed her through the set of chrome-clad double doors at the end of the hallway. Inside, it was the typical loud music and flashing lights. The dance floor was spacious but packed, maybe 50 couples. Andy saw more bare skin than Priscilla had led her to believe she would. The pink pasties theme had apparently drawn out the exhibitionists in spades. Low-slung couches and tables surrounded the dance floor. Many of the tables had a brass pole. Housewives in G-strings honed their amateur stripping skills. Men in tight briefs played underwear model. A few even had the six-packs to pull it off. On the enormous wall behind the DJ were at least a dozen flat screens. Technologically, it was a match for even the greatest of sports bars, except that the only thing to watch was porn.
See that guy over there? Asked Priscilla, pointing with a subtle nod.
Andy shot a discreet glance across the dance floor. The man's partner was in the process of removing his shirt.
Good looking, right? Asked Priscilla.
I'd say so. Fair warning. He's only got one testicle.
I know, you think I'm shallow and your politically correct reaction is probably, oh, one nut, so what? Funny thing about balls, though. You don't really pay much attention to them, but you kind of miss them when they're not there.
Andy wasn't sure how to respond.
Like grandparents, I guess.
Priscilla laughed.
I like you, yeah. Grandparents.
Andy looked away, but Priscilla tugged at her arm.
Over there, she said at the end of the bar, that's definitely someone you should know about.
She meant another man who was definitely in the wishful age category. The brunette on his right arm and the blonde on his left were a little more than half his age, and in Andy's quick estimation, well out of his league.
He's really not much to look at, said Andy.
Craig has the biggest unit in the club.
Oh.
I'm not kidding.
I measured it. That thing goes from my elbow to the tip of my little finger. No exaggeration. It must take 90% of the blood in his entire body to get it.
Priscilla went on, but Andy had tuned out after little finger. She was thinking back to her conversation at the tile depot earlier in the week. At the time, the warehouse manager's quip about the prison nickname for Marco's friend had seemed superfluous.
Not anymore.
Excuse me,
said Andy, but did you say from your elbow to your pinky?
Yeah, all the way to the tip of it. Can you believe that?
By any chance do people call him Pinky?
As a matter of fact, they do. It's a joke. They call him Pinky because he's enormous, said Andy, finishing for her.
Exactly. How did you know that?
Andy glanced across the bar. It had to be the same Pinky, Marco's friend, which was satisfying on many levels. She'd hit pay dirt without having to eat hairy sushi, wear pink pasties, or take a week-long shower.
Let's just say his reputation precedes him, said Andy.
Chapter 26. On Saturday morning, Reuben dug up more money. Friday had been another gangbuster night at the restaurant, and it was after 2 a.m. when he'd finally gone home. He woke before sunrise so neighbors would not see him digging in the yard. He took only what he needed, left the rest in the PVC pipe, and covered up the hole. A flick of a knife removed the vacuum-sealed packaging. The bills went into a backpack. Savannah was still in bed when he stepped out of the shower, and it wasn't his intention to wake her before leaving. He almost made it.
Where are you going, honey?
He was at the front door reaching for the knob. She was standing across the room wrapped in her peach terry cloth robe, her hair up in a chip clip.
Oh, you're up.
I am now, she said. Where are you going?
Back to the restaurant, he said, lying. A pipe broke in the kitchen last night. I need to see if I can fix it. Got my tools right here, he said, patting his backpack of money.
Can't you call a plumber?
Ha, he said, smiling. Do you have any idea what a plumber charges on a weekend? I'd have to get Jeffrey to knock off another money flight to cover his bill.
She folded her arms, clearly not amused.
Please don't joke about that. Jeffrey's lucky to be alive. I'm still very worried about him.
We both are.
He laid his backpack on the floor, keeping a safe distance between Savannah and what was really inside it. Then he crossed the room and put his arms around her.
I told both him and your mother that they should pack their bags and get out of Miami. I can't put a gun to their heads and force them to go.
Savannah laid her head against his chest, but she kept her eyes wide open, thinking.
I think we should turn in the money.
Reuben froze, then took a step back.
You what?
We don't have to tell the police that Jeffrey stole it.
We can say that we were walking along a bike trail and saw a $100 bill on the ground. We looked around and saw another one and then another one. Then we found a whole bag of money that the crooks had buried, and some animals must have dug it up.
Animals? Dug up?
It was actually possible. He took another step back, suddenly feeling the need to sit, and leaned against the back of the couch.
That's just a bad idea.
Why?
We find millions of dollars in a bag and we just turn it in. That's our story.
Yeah. We did the right thing. Why is that a bad idea?
It's not believable.
Why not?
First of all, where do you think we live, Mayberry?
Nobody in Miami finds that much money and just turns it in.
That's not true.
I remember a story on the news just a few years ago. An armored car got in an accident and overturned on I-95. Two kids turned in the money.
No, I remember that story too. It was almost $500,000 that spilled out of the truck. Two kids found $55 and returned it. The rest of the folks, they just kept the money. The city practically threw a parade in honor of the kids who stepped up.
because no one could believe they did it. That's Miami.
Savannah walked around the couch and sat on the armrest. She was right beside Reuben, leaning against him. I'm afraid that the longer we keep this money hidden, the harder it is to figure out what to do about it.
Reuben reached for her hand and held it. It's going to be okay.
What about Pinky?
He felt a chill. What about him?
You still have his share of the money, right?
He didn't, but he'd told her otherwise, and he was sticking to it. Yeah, his and Jeffrey's share. Or at least I thought I did. Jeffrey had some cash I didn't know about, enough to come up with a $400,000 ransom. I suppose Pinky does too.
We can turn in whatever we have. How much is it?
He'd never told her. And putting an exact number on it would make it even harder to maintain equilibrium in the ebb and flow of lies mixed with truth.
Savannah, put this idea out of your head. If we don't have all the money, turning in part of it doesn't solve anything.
She sighed deeply.
Pinky is such a scumbag. Even if we could convince Jeffrey to turn in the money, he'll never make this right.
You never know what'll happen.
Have you been in touch with him?
Last time we talked, he said he was leaving Miami.
Just as well. He scares me. He was always nice to me when I was a little girl. Used to bring me presents whenever he came over to the house. But even before he went to prison, he scared me.
I'll take care of Pinky. She looked at him with concern.
What does that mean?
Don't worry. I'm not going to do anything stupid.
You promise?
You have to trust me on this, Savannah. Their eyes met and held. Then she smiled a little, but it was a sad one.
Okay. I trust you.
Reuben drove south and didn't stop until he was almost to the Florida Keys. It was his first visit to Eden Park. The Eden Park mobile home community was 27 acres of manufactured housing, a flat and treeless tract of agricultural land that the county had rezoned residential to accommodate thousands of migrant workers who worked the surrounding fields of beans and tomatoes each winter. Like many who'd lost a house in foreclosure, Reuben and Savannah had considered the manufactured housing option before deciding to rent. Some mobile home parks were beautiful, having made it from one hurricane season to the next with nary a sign of damage from wind or rain. Eden Park was not one of them. When it came to tropical storms, Eden Park was like that unknowing kid in middle school who walks around all day with the kick me sign pasted to his back. It bore the scars of every major storm to make landfall in the last decade. Empty lots of plenty, the demolished houses long since hauled away. Some homeowners bought storm-damaged units on the cheap and fixed them up, good as new. Some bought as-is, unable to afford the necessary repairs. Windows remained boarded with plywood year-round, the roof perpetually covered with blue plastic tarps, the temporary fixes that never went away. The bluest of all was at the end of Eden Lane. Reuben stopped and parked alongside the gravel road that bisected the park. He rolled down the window and sat behind the wheel for a minute. Just ahead, a little farther down the street, boys and girls were kicking a soccer ball. They looked to be around kindergarten age. In a place like Eden Park, video games were a luxury. Kids learned to kick a soccer ball almost before they could walk. All of these youngsters were good. One boy in particular was skilled for his age. Good ball control, dribbled with both feet, excellent speed. Reuben watched him with passing interest, focusing more on the feisty little girl who kept stealing the ball from him.
Reuben, you can't buy back what's lost. Savannah was so wrong. She could not have been more wrong. Reuben climbed out of the car, grabbed one more glimpse of the Eden Park World Cup, and walked to the front door of the trailer with the blue roof. He had his backpack with him. He knocked firmly. No one answered. He knocked again, and the main door opened, but the storm door remained closed. The old woman on the other side of the screen wasn't smiling. Her expression soured even more when she recognized Reuben. "What the heck do you want?" she asked.
"Can we talk?"
"We got nothing to talk about. Please. I want to make things right." She scoffed and shook her head. "It could mean some money for you," he said.
Money.
The magic word with Edith Baird. She had once been a pro at working the system. When her daughter and Reuben had dated, Edith was living comfortably in a four-bedroom house with a swimming pool. A felony conviction for welfare fraud put an end to the scam. Unfortunately, the pendulum swung too far in the opposite direction, and now the monthly assistance check wasn't even close to what she needed.
"You got 2 minutes," she said as she opened the screen door.
Reuben thanked her and went inside. The living room was a cluttered mess. In fact, it wasn't used as a living room. An ironing board stood in the middle of it. Several damp loads from the morning wash hung on the drying racks, mostly children's clothes, lots of pink.
"How are you doing, Edith?"
Edith was a large woman with enormous, flabby triceps that sagged over her elbows and ankles so swollen that Reuben would have sworn she didn't have any. Her old sundress was at least 2 sizes too small, which didn't make it any easier to bend at the waist. Just lowering herself into a chair seemed to leave her breathless.
"How's it look like I'm doing?"
"Mindy okay?"
He meant his ex-girlfriend, Edith's only child.
"Locked up. Another parole violation. At least if she's in jail, I know she's not selling her body and doing drugs. I guess that's something to be thankful for. That can't be what you hear about, to talk about Mindy."
"No."
Reuben moved to the edge of the couch, leveling his gaze at Edith.
"I'm here about my daughter."
"Kyla ain't your daughter, Reuben. You never married her mother, and you gave up any possible paternal rights you had when I adopted her."
"I understand. And I regret that."
"Well, that's a damn shame. It's too late now."
"Is it?"
"Course it is. Kyla's lived with me her whole life. She'll be 5 years old next month."
Reuben paused, making sure he struck the right tone.
"Edith, I was watching the children play soccer out on the street before I came up to your door. How many kids are you raising in this trailer?"
Edith glanced at the drying racks in the middle of the living room.
"3. Kyla, Alex, and Dylan. They share the other bedroom."
"How much longer can a girl share a room with 2 boys?
"As long as she has to."
"Do the fathers help with the boys?"
"Mindy don't even know who the fathers are," she said. "You're the only boyfriend she ever had. And what a piece of shit you turned out to be."
Reuben averted his gaze, then looked her in the eye.
"I'm sorry about that. I've changed."
"Yeah, so has Mindy. For the worse."
"I want to help."
She scoffed again, dubious.
"Really? How?"
The backpack was at his feet. He picked it up and handed it to her.
"Open it."
"What's this?"
"Have a look for yourself."
She unzipped it, peeked inside, and froze.
Money, she said, gasping. My God! How much is this?
$100,000.
Where did you get that kind of money?
I'm doing all right these days.
Baloney.
It doesn't matter where I got it, he said. The question is, do you want it?
What kind of question is that?
Reuben replied in the most level, matter-of-fact tone he could muster.
Do you want it, Edith?
Well, of course I want it. Who wouldn't want $100,000?
But I've been around the block. I know there ain't no such thing as something for nothing.
He spoke in the same even tone. I want to adopt Kyla.
Ha! She said, half laughing, half scoffing. You want Kyla?
Reuben was deadpan, no change in his expression.
Well, that's just beautiful, said Edith. You want Kyla. Kyla. Do you think you can just walk in here and buy a little girl like she's for sale?
His tone didn't change.
Yes, I do.
Silence. Reuben took it as a good sign. If it weren't in the cards, she would have thrown him out immediately.
I love that child, said Edith.
$100,000 is my opening offer, Edith. It's negotiable.
And she loves me.
You make a strong case. You will be treated fairly. I'm sure we can agree on a number.
Edith blinked, another good sign. Reuben saw a flicker of hope, a sparkle in her eye that bespoke the old Edith, the one who'd pretended to be deathly ill and then split $10,000 with a doctor who'd billed Medicare for treatment never rendered.
How can I be sure this money isn't counterfeit? For all I know, you went into some fancy copy center and printed it yourself.
Take one. Pick any bill you like.
Reuben removed a stack from the backpack and laid the bills on the table, fanning them like playing cards.
Take a closer look, he said. Some bills are crisp. Others are worn around the edges. These aren't freshly printed fakes with consecutive serial numbers. These have been circulated. She seemed to take his point, but he could still see suspicion in her eyes. Take one, he said.
Edith pulled one from the middle of the stack.
Keep it, said Reuben. Take it to any department store in Miami. They'll check the watermark, test the paper with that colored marker pen they use. They'll tell you it's real. Then you call me.
Reuben rose. He reached for the backpack, but she held on to it for a second or two, and he could feel the pull as he retrieved it. A look of angst came over her as she finally let go of the money. Reuben smiled thinly, then turned serious.
Don't worry. This offer is not going away. You think about it and let me know. Good to see you again, Edith.
He swung the backpack over one shoulder and let himself out. Chapter 27. Pinky woke in the red room, alone. Closing time at Night Moves was 5 a.m., but it wasn't unusual for Pinky to find an empty bed in one of the private cabanas and sleep till noon on Saturday. It was a perk of being one of the club's select gentlemen, a handful of members with special talents who weren't required to have a woman in their company to enter the club. They serviced the women of other members. He fumbled in the darkness and found the dimmer switch on the wall. Even at full power, it was mood lighting at best, which was fine. His eyes couldn't have handled an all-out assault.
His head pounded as he stepped out of the cabana. He wasn't sure what he'd been drinking all night, but it made everything a blur. Almost everything. He remembered leaving the bar with two women. It was a typical scenario. Their husbands had been dancing with other women most of the night, and the wives were curious to find out if the anatomical rumors about Pinky were true. As always, he was more than happy to deliver. Mornings after, however, were getting more and more difficult.
Damn, my back hurts.
He straightened out the kink in his spine, pulled on his pants, and walked to the locker room. Members paid extra for a locker and shower access. But for the select gentlemen, that was another freebie. Pinky had a prime locker directly across from the viewing window that looked out onto the Lovenasium, where some of the hottest action in the club took place, usually around 2 a.m. He found his key and opened the locker. His shaving kit was on the top shelf where he'd left it. His cash was not.
Fucking bitches!
Another $5,000 picked clean. It was the second time since the heist that prostitutes, claiming to be another man's wife, had lured him into a cabana, plied him with a special BYOB concoction until he passed out, and then cleaned out the cash from his locker. He could never prove it, of course. There were no cameras in the locker rooms, security or otherwise. He was starting to feel as stupid as his nephew at the gold rush.
At least I'm actually getting laid.
He showered, got dressed, and headed down the dimly lit hall to the exit. His friend stopped him in the lobby before he reached the door. It was the club owner, Jorge Calderon.
I need to talk to you, said Calderon.
What about?
In my office. It's important.
Pinky followed him. Important could mean a lot of things, especially between two old friends who'd known each other since their sophomore year at Miami Senior High School. They drifted apart after graduation, but reconnected a decade later when Calderon owned the body shop. Pinky couldn't count the number of stolen vehicles he'd pushed through Calderon's chop shop. Business was so good that Calderon had branched out with night moves. Pinky held no financial stake in either business, but the club benefits were definitely tangible.
Have a seat, said Calderon.
Pinky settled into the chair. Calderon sat behind his desk.
Bro, why so serious?
Asked Pinky.
I'm sorry, Pinky. I can't have you hanging here no more.
What?
Every other select gentleman in my club is under 30. You're 45. You had a good run, but it's time.
But I don't look 45.
Now you sound like Priscilla.
Have you stood in front of a mirror lately?
So you're kicking me out of the club?
No, you're welcome to come if you bring a woman with you. But no more select gentleman status.
This is really harsh, bro.
It's nothing personal, said Calderon. This is business.
Business.
I'm grooming the club to sell it. I have investors coming in from Brazil, Singapore, all over. These people have a keen eye for what a club like this is worth. It has to be top-notch. I can't have my select gentlemen asking for the AARP discount on their club dues.
I'm not that old.
You're closer than you think. The point is, if I'm going to get top dollar for this club, I have to get rid of the dinosaurs.
Speaking of dinosaurs, size does matter.
Not to these buyers.
They're looking for a first-rate operation with some style and flash, not a red light district freak show.
Ouch!
Now you're really getting harsh, bro.
I'm sorry, but I'm not just testing the waters here to see what I can get. I need to sell this place.
Pinky's gaze drifted toward the montage of photographs on the wall. Nurse's night.
Pinky had been on fire at that event. Hard to believe it was 12 years ago.
What if I buy the club?
Calderon smiled and shook his head.
You can't raise that kind of dough.
Pinky had told his old friend nothing about his involvement in the heist, not a word about chopping the pickup truck at Calderon's shop, and even less about the job his bodywork mechanic had done with a blowtorch on Marco Arroyo.
What if I could raise the money?
Get real, Pinky. I'm asking $5 million.
Pinky did the quick calculations. His share was $2.5 million. He still had Marco's share of $1 million. He'd blown through at least $100,000, but it wasn't beyond reach.
Would you take four?
No way. Five is practically land value. My broker would lock me up in an insane asylum if I went a penny lower.
And let's stop pretending like you even have four.
Give me 2 weeks. I can get five.
Are you serious?
Pinky glanced at the photos on the wall again. Nurses galore, and his equipment had been just what the doctor ordered.
Never been more serious in my life, bro.
His real name is Craig Perez, said Andy. She'd stopped by the Little Ferds townhouse to update her supervisor, and she was on his patio again. Little Ferd had the Saturday edition of the Miami Herald in his lap. He was one of those tactile, nostalgic types who clung to a real weekend newspaper, especially when relaxing in his Adirondack chair on a perfect South Florida afternoon in November. His gaze was fixed on a pair of blue jays in the poinciana tree as Andy filled him in about Pinky. I'd like to get a wiretap. He turned his attention from the blue jays to Andy, thoroughly unimpressed.
You have a guy with a big schmeckle and one prior for auto theft who stopped by the Tile Depot looking for Marco Arroyo after the heist, is that it?
And who also quit his job 2 days after the heist. I tracked that down this morning.
Still not enough, said Littleford.
I went back and watched the video from the security cameras. Pinky has the same build as the perp with the gun. Similar walk, too.
You're getting warm?
No offense, Michael, but that would have been enough for my supervisor in Seattle.
You're not in Seattle.
I have a hunch about this one.
A hunch isn't probable cause for a wiretap.
She had another angle, but just then Littleford's wife stepped out to say hello.
Andy, hi there.
So sorry you weren't able to meet up with my cousin John last night.
Talk about a schmeckle, Littleford muttered.
What was that, honey?
Asked Barbara.
Nothing, he said.
Barbara smiled at Andy.
Perhaps we can set something up for next weekend. I'll have to check my calendar.
Please do, said Barbara.
And let me know. I'll leave you two alone now.
She stepped back into the kitchen and closed the sliding glass door. Littleford apologized.
No worries, said Andy. Back to our man.
Forget the wiretap for now. Let's put a tail on him. We don't need probable cause to do that.
No, but we do need money.
Between the tail on Alvarez and your undercover gig at Night Moves, we've already blown through half our surveillance budget.
Can't you request an increase?
Not based on what you've told me. Look, Andy. Miami-Dade has the Marco Arroyo homicide investigation. From the FBI standpoint, this is basically a property crime that doesn't involve terrorism, cyber threats, public corruption, civil rights, or major crime syndicates. Unless this Pinky has a direct link to Al-Qaeda, there's no chance in hell that I can get a budget increase to tail him.
The Blue Jays were fighting, drawing Andy's gaze toward the tree.
Sorry, he said. I didn't mean to sound condescending. But in the world we live in, my unit does more with less. It's expected. Frankly, I find it to be part of the challenge that gets me up every morning. Working a case means
working a case, not putting in a budget request for the latest gadget that makes teenage boys in movie theaters say, ooh, awesome.
Okay, I get it.
I'm probably not helping my efforts to recruit you into the bank robber unit, am I?
On the contrary, I really do get it.
They sat in silence for a moment. But a supervisor who believed in what he was doing and didn't try to oversell it, that only made Andy want to work harder. You have any objection if I tail him on my own time? She asked.
No, but understand that it truly will be in your free time. It doesn't count toward availability pay, you won't get credit for unscheduled duty, and you won't get reimbursed for any of your expenses.
She shrugged.
What else am I going to do with my weekend?
Have a blind date with Barbara's cousin?
He smiled.
Keep me posted on what turns up. And who knows? Maybe you'll get that wiretap after all.
Count on it, she said.
Chapter 28. On Tuesday morning, Reuben had a $1 million delivery to make. Rush hour was just getting underway, and he was right on time. Three lanes of northbound traffic crept along US 1 toward downtown Miami. The western suburbs drained into the northerly flow from Bird Road. In peak traffic, commuters could easily wait at the intersection through four or five light cycles, a good 20 minutes, just to make that dreaded left turn. Shaded by the elevated metro rail tracks overhead, it was a prime panhandling opportunity for anyone with the street credentials to work it. On this Tuesday, like every Tuesday, it was up to Reuben to decide who had what it takes and who didn't. The usual homeless suspects rode in the back seat of his car, with the notable exception of the previous week's disaster. The guy who'd deposited the chief symptom of irritable bowel syndrome on Reuben's upholstery. The others had lost or forgotten their please help signs, of course. Reuben gave them new ones and sent them off with a standing order about the $300 minimum. Chicken scratch compared to what was in the backpack on the seat beside him. Reuben pulled onto the shoulder and watched his team get into position. They knew the drill. No one walked straight toward the shade beneath the tracks and curled up for a nap, which was surprising. Usually at least one joker sat down on the job from the get-go. Reuben did notice an old man going from car to car in the far lane, collecting a buck or two from the puppet figures he'd fashioned by hand from palm fronds. Grasshoppers and butterflies were his big sellers. He was an artist. He was also a squatter, operating without authority, and technically, Reuben should have flexed his muscles and told him to beat it. This morning, however, he was in no mood for small-time Miami. I can't wait to be done with this crap. He put the car in gear and pulled back onto Bird Road. Westbound traffic was non-existent, so he zipped right across the street to the parking lot in front of the convenience store, the designated meeting spot for the delivery. Reuben felt good about this split. Pinky was a dirtbag, Jeffrey was a loser, Monaco, who the hell knew how far out into the bay the river currents and tides had carried his body. But Octavio Alvarez had been his buddy since boyhood. They'd started boxing together at the gym as seven-year-olds, knocking each other around the ring, equally determined to be Cuba's next gold medalist. They used to watch the Cuban national baseball team practice through a hole in the right field fence, then scrape together their moneda nacional to buy a scoop of chocolate ice cream at the world-famous Copelia. Test scores and other academic indicators landed them in separate high schools, but most of Reuben's friends at the Vocational Pre-University Institute of Exact Sciences stopped talking to him after he got kicked off the college track for violating the government's ban on access to the Internet. It didn't seem to matter that he hadn't been planning to overthrow the regime, that he'd been searching for information about his dead Russian father. Alvarez was the old friend who had stuck by him. More than stuck by him. "Let's get a raft to Florida," he told Reuben. So they did. And of course, if it hadn't been for Alvarez and his work at the armored car company, there would have been no heist. Reuben checked his rearview mirror.
A homeless man was approaching from Bird Road. He was wearing blue jeans, an army jacket, a beanie, and sneakers. The gnarly beard and cheap sunglasses were the finishing touches on a convincing disguise. If Reuben hadn't known Alvarez was coming, he would never have known it was him. Reuben lowered the window. Alvarez stepped up to the driver's side and held out his hand.
"Got any spare change, Mr. Trump?"
Reuben handed him the backpack. He'd brought all hundreds for Octavio to lighten the load, but a cubic foot of tightly packed currency was still a good 20 pounds.
"Don't spend it all in one place."
"Thanks, bro.
Good luck."
Alvarez slung the backpack over one shoulder, smiled, and walked away from the car. Reuben continued to watch in the rearview mirror. The westbound lanes on Bird Road were still clear. The rush hour traffic headed in the opposite direction. Alvarez didn't even bother to look before crossing, or perhaps he'd looked but just didn't see. Reuben saw and heard it all. The flash of blue metal on wheels, the moment of panic as his friend froze in the middle of the street, the sickening thud of a human body on the losing end of a hip-to-hood collision with a speeding blue automobile.
"Octavio!"
The impact sent Alvarez flying at least 30 feet before he landed on the pavement. The car screeched to a halt, but Alvarez was motionless, his body a grotesque heap on the road. Reuben rushed from his car. His gaze locked onto Alvarez, but out of the corner of his eye, he saw the man with the puppets made from palm fronds, the homeless artist, running toward Alvarez. The artist grabbed the backpack, flung open the passenger side door, and jumped in. The car sped off in reverse. With no plate on the front bumper, Reuben couldn't get the license number. Only when the driver reached the end of the block did he back into a driveway, turn the car around, and squeal away. By then, the car was too far away to see the plate on the rear bumper.
"Shit!"
Reuben started toward his friend, then stopped. Several other commuters had jumped out of their vehicles and were already tending to him. One was on a cell phone, presumably talking to 911. A pool of blood stained the pavement. Alvarez wasn't moving. Reuben took another half step forward, then stopped. His conscience was nudging him toward his friend and telling him to do all he could to help. Another voice told him that there was nothing he could do, at least not anything that other Good Samaritans weren't already doing. The most compelling message was also the most frightening. Staying at the scene would mean talking to the police, which would link him directly to the armored car insider who'd organized the heist.
"Sorry, old friend."
Reuben gathered one last glimpse of the lifeless body in the road, then turned away and got into his car. He headed west, out of the parking lot, against rush hour, no traffic to contend with. He checked his rearview mirror and saw the flashing lights. An ambulance and two squad cars were arriving. It was a good thing he'd left, and not just because the victim was Alvarez. As he drove away, one thought burned in his mind. The guy driving the car, speeding away in reverse, he looked a lot like Pinky. Chapter 29. Savannah had a knot in her stomach. It had nothing to do with her usual tasks at the daycare center. Drop-off went smoothly. Flagpole proceeded as usual. I pledge allegiance to the flag. Only two kids wet their pants during the early morning recess. The cause of her indigestion was the scheduled follow-up meeting with the Department of Children and Family Services. It was supposed to happen at 9 a.m. while her three-year-olds were in movement class with the dance instructor. Betty could have really good news for her, or really, really bad. At 5 minutes before nine, Betty phoned from her car. She was in the daycare parking lot and wanted Savannah to step outside to meet her. The knot tightened. Savannah quickly herded her children into the playroom.
The kids were supposed to sit cross-legged in a big circle for movement class, but Savannah's class was more like an amoeba. A colleague helped her out, and Savannah tried not to appear too distressed as she excused herself, exited the building, and found Betty standing beside her hatchback.
"Savannah, I'm sorry to call you out to the parking lot, but I was afraid there might be tears in front of the children."
It was a dagger to the heart.
"I'm not going to be approved?"
She shook her head.
"No, you're not approved."
Savannah took a breath. When Betty had said there might be tears, Savannah had reached inside herself and vowed there wouldn't be. Yet she found herself wiping one away.
"Is it because of..."
She stopped and glanced over her shoulder to make sure no one was within earshot.
"Because of Reuben?"
"Yes."
"But you told me that his criminal record was not a definite bar."
"That was true," Betty said.
"There are circumstances where DCF can work around it, depending on what the conviction was for, especially if it was a long time ago."
"Reuben was 18, a teenager. Did you tell the review committee that?"
"I did."
"I don't get it.
If ever there was a case with, what did you call it, circumstances?"
"Mitigating circumstances."
"Right.
This is one of those cases. It's a proven fact that organized criminals in Miami would go down to Havana and tell teenage boys they could have a free ride to Florida. Reuben took the bait, and then when he got here, they told him he had to hijack a truckload of designer jeans or something, or they would send him back to Cuba. He got caught, and he did his time. He wasn't deported. He straightened himself out and is a U.S. citizen. There's no reason he shouldn't be a father."
Betty didn't answer.
"So, don't you agree with me?"
asked Savannah. The social worker looked away, then back.
"Let me say this. I don't think you're lying to me."
"No, I'm not lying. It's the truth."
Betty hesitated, as if searching for the right words.
"When I say I don't think you're lying, I mean that in my judgment, you absolutely believe it to be true."
"Of course I believe it. I confronted my husband about this when the private agency told me he had a felony conviction. He told me the whole story."
"Yes,
that's what he told you. A story." Savannah's defensive instincts kicked in, and she had to check herself to keep from speaking too loudly.
"Are you accusing him of making this up?" "I'm very sorry to be the one to tell you this, Savannah. We did a thorough background check on your husband. He was convicted of a felony, but it wasn't when he was a teenager, and it wasn't for hijacking a truck."
Savannah glanced toward the older children on the other side of the fence. An argument was brewing on the monkey bars. Another assistant handled it. Savannah refocused.
"When was it?"
"You really don't know?"
"Apparently not.
His first conviction was 5 years ago.
That was before we met."
"But wait. First conviction? There's more than one?"
"I'm afraid so."
"What for?"
"Domestic violence."
That knot in her stomach was only getting worse.
"That's not possible. I'm his first wife." "I understand your confusion. Florida is one of the few states with old laws on the books making it a crime to cohabitate, but fortunately, the legislature saw fit to extend domestic violence protection where a man and a woman are unmarried, but in the same household. Your husband was living with his accuser."
"Well, domestic violence can mean a lot of things."
"Yes, it can. and all too often it's a pattern of conduct. That's why I came here today. I didn't want to just make a phone call and cancel the appointment. She reached out and gently touched Savannah's hand. I'm worried for you. A warm breeze rustled the palm trees behind them, but Savannah suddenly felt chills. What did he do? Betty reached into her satchel and pulled out the DCF file. Is there some place we can go to discuss this? No. I don't want to go anywhere. Tell me now. Tell me exactly what Reuben did. Betty cracked open the file and put on her reading glasses. Let's start at the beginning, she said. Chapter 30. A white tarp lay atop the pavement and the ghostly form of a life cut short. Yellow tape cordoned off a block-long stretch of Bird Road, from busy US 1 to the corner convenience store. Special Agent Henning, Andy said with a flash of her badge to the perimeter control officers. Police beacons swirled atop a half-dozen squad cars, and sparks belched from a line of roadside flares as Florida Highway Patrol directed traffic toward a slow-moving detour. The reroute affected only westbound traffic, but rubberneckers in the eastbound rush hour were doing their best to make everyone late for work. A crowd watched from a parking lot. Several snapped photographs, seizing the opportunity to update their Facebook page with something more exciting than the usual captivating close-up of what they were eating for breakfast. Two ambulances were on the scene, but paramedics were in standby mode. Nothing to be done. A plain white van from the medical examiner's office was parked in the outer lane, its rear doors agape, a gurney at the ready. The black T-shirts worn by the MDPD investigators were standard issue, but they seemed to underscore the fact that this was indeed a fatality, a cause for mourning.
Lieutenant Watts is right over there, the officer said as Andy ducked beneath the police tape. Next to the body?
The 911 callers had described the victim as a homeless Hispanic man, but the first officer on the scene quickly noted the fake beard. It was equally strange that a homeless man would carry a wallet with a valid driver's license and a current employee identification card from Braxton Security. Andy was on the scene before official confirmation that it was the same Octavio Alvarez who was a person of interest in the MIA heist.
That's definitely him, Andy said as she peeled back the tarp.
Watts was at her side, along with Sergeant Collins from the MDPD Traffic Homicide Unit. A media helicopter whirred overhead, drawing their attention from the bloodied asphalt to the crisp blue sky.
What do we know about the vehicle? Asked Andy.
Blue two-door sedan, said Collins. Witnesses don't agree on the make or model. That may not sound like much to go on, but this is my 91st hit-and-run this year. Blue two-door sedan is more than we started with and better than half of them.
Did anyone get the tag? Asked Andy.
Yeah, ran it. No connection to any blue sedan. It's from a Jeep that was reported stolen 8 weeks ago.
It was premature to point out every possible connection between the heist and the hit-and-run, but Andy made a mental note that the body shop that shopped a certain black Ford pickup would also be a ready source of stolen license plates. A detective from the traffic homicide unit approached.
Got something, he told the lieutenant.
Andy listened as they talked. It was about a homeless man selling origami grasshoppers made out of palm fronds. Three witnesses had seen him grab the victim's backpack, jump in the car, and flee with the hit-and-run driver.
Get those witnesses down to the station for an artist composite, said Watts. Will do, sir.
He left quickly, so Andy put her question to Watts. Are there cameras at this intersection?
None, said Watts.
How soon can you get the manpower to check the business establishments along the street? Their security cameras could have picked up the car, or...